Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, August 6th, and I'm Nat Cardos, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, pond fire updates, McKinleyville structure fire, Orleans complex fire update, and cause of sea star waste disease discovered. Hope for the future of the sunflower sea star. So stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
At approximately 3:40 p.m., a full wildland response was dispatched just north of Highway 101 in Laytonville. The fire is currently at 23.1 acres and is holding in the retardant and along roads. Fire resources requested are 4 water tankers, 5 engines, 2 hand crews, and 1 dozer. Traffic alert per Caltrans District 1 Facebook release. The pond fire is burning north of Laytonville in Mendocino County. US 101 is currently open and motorists are asked to drive with caution. Please check quickmap.dot.ca.gov or the QuickMap app for the latest road conditions. Per Mendocino County Sheriff's Office, an evacuation warning is now in place for the Laytonville area, MM 73.16 North Highway 101. Be ready to evacuate at any moment. Gather your belongings, check on your neighbors, and leave early if possible. Please avoid the area. Emergency crews need access. Do not block the road. Only call 911 for emergencies. We will publish more information, including evacuation zone maps and social media updates, to mendoready.org as more information becomes available. As of news time, the pond fire is still active, and KMUD News will continue with updates as soon as we receive information. At approximately 4:31 p.m. today, a residential structure fire was reported in the 1800 block of Archer in McKinleyville. According to scanner traffic, the caller said they saw flames coming from underneath the home. An all-call was issued, and units from the Arcata Fire District, Blue Lake Volunteer Fire Department, Fieldbrook Volunteer Fire Department, and West Haven Volunteer Fire Department responded. The first crew on the scene confirmed active fire in the crawl space of a single-story, single-family residence. Firefighters quickly initiated an aggressive fire attack to contain the blaze. The incident commander later reported that the fire had originated as a vegetation fire, which then spread to the home and igniting the exterior wall, making its way into the crawl space. Despite initial concern, the incident commander indicated that the situation could be managed with the resources they already had on hand. No injuries or damage estimates were available at the time of reporting. Today's fire update on the Orleans Complex fires from the CAL FIRE press release. The Big Cliff Fire continues to burn in Siskiyou County at 797 acres and is currently 7% contained. Across the fire, interior smoldering fuel is generating smoke, especially in the afternoons. Firefighters will be in the Rainbow Mine area focusing on structure protection. The Pacific Crest Trail remains closed between Carter Summit to Etna Summit. The Butler Fire also continues to burn to the west of the Big Cliff Fire and is 21,058 acres at 94% containment. The fire has not grown for several days, and resources are monitoring and patrolling, mopping up, chipping material, and backhauling equipment. Motorists are advised to exercise caution when traveling through the burned area, as the risk of unexpected debris across roadways remains. Drier air from a cold front that will come through early Thursday will keep afternoon humidity at critical levels, with potential for afternoon gusts of up to 20 to 25 miles per hour each day. Evacuation orders and warnings are in place for the immediate vicinity of the fire. For current evacuation status, visit facebook.com/SiskiyouCountySheriff and facebook.com/SiskiyouCountyOES. Additional evacuation information can be found on protect.genesys.com. That's protect.genasys.com. Many forest roads and trails in the region are still closed. For updates, check the Six Rivers National Forest website or the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Facebook page. Tune in to KMUD Local News for continued coverage of the 2025 local fire season. On August 4th, an international research effort discovered the cause of sea star wasting disease, a disease that wiped out more than 90% of the sunflower sea star population. Sunflower sea stars used to be considered common in the eastern Pacific Ocean, being found along the west coast of the United States from Alaska to Baja California. These sea stars are the largest in the world, with 24 arms and growing up to the size of a bicycle tire. Starting in 2013, sunflower sea stars, as well as sea stars in up to 20 species, started dying off in epidemic proportions along the West Coast from sea star wasting disease. For years, no one knew what caused sea star wasting disease, but it has now been revealed as a strain of the bacterium Vibrio pectinicida in a newly published study in Nature, Ecology, and Evolution. Vibrio is a genus of bacteria that naturally live in coastal waters and has devastated coral and shellfish, as well as humans. For example, Vibrio chlorae is the pathogen that causes cholera. KMUD News spoke with Catherine Kilduff, senior attorney in the Oceans Program at the Center for Biological Diversity, to talk about sea star wasting disease and the sunflower sea star.
Sea star wasting disease causes sea stars' arms to fall off and walk away from them, and then they basically disintegrate into a gooey mass, which is horrifying, and it happens over a couple of days, which is really quick in the wild, so scientists have a hard time studying the outbreak when it occurs. Sea stars are really important for the health of our kelp forests on the Pacific coast. They're predators of urchins and shellfish bivalves, and so the urchins eat the kelp, and as a result of the decline of sea stars, the urchins have been eating away at the kelp forest. The sunflower sea star was one of the most common sea stars on the West Coast, and this wasting disease that emerged in 2013 devastated the population. Billions of them died, and so this has had a huge ecological consequence on the Pacific coast.
Other sea star die-offs have happened in the past, though not at this magnitude. For example, in 1978, large numbers of the Gulf Sun Star, a type of sea star native to the coast of California, Gulf of Mexico, and Nicaragua, succumbed to a wasting disease in the Gulf of California. The sea star became locally extinct in parts of the Gulf. This sea star's disappearance still has profound effects on the ecosystem. The difference between that epidemic and this current one, which started in 2013, is the magnitude at which sea stars are dying off. Since 2013, billions of sea stars have succumbed to the sea star wasting disease, leaving a hole in the ecosystem and allowing animals of which they usually feed on, like urchins, to eat up and destroy kelp forests. Kilduff explains the importance of sea stars in marine ecosystems and what happens when they die off.
Yeah, there have been sea star die-offs in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but those have really only caused declines in local populations. For example, in Southern California and the Channel Islands. What was unique about the sea star wasting disease that emerged in 2013 was that it was seen from southeastern Alaska all the way into Baja California, into Mexico, up and down the coast. And it affected over 20 sea star species. And like I mentioned, the sunflower sea star was one of the most common sea stars. And there were areas where they couldn't be found anymore. And so that's caused this huge effect on the Pacific coast. The causes of sea star wasting disease were unknown until this week, when scientists published a paper saying it's caused by a bacteria that's commonly found in ocean water and was known to affect scallops and other bivalves prior to this, but hadn't been seen in sea stars. But they showed that it was the causative agent. And so the fact that they just discovered what was causing it means that now they can figure out steps on how to stop the spread and help these sea stars recover.
As of now, the cause of this disease has been identified, though the method of sea stars contracting it is still unknown. According to the study, the effects of the disease appear to be stronger in warmer water, and other species of Vibrio are also known to multiply in warm water.
Yeah, the scientists are still trying to figure out how the bacteria is transmitted to sea stars and whether it comes from the prey that they're eating, those bivalves. And so there's still more research that needs to be done, and I'm hoping that this new discovery will spur more research funding into these focused areas And then also, we know that this particular outbreak was associated with warmer waters. And so the sea stars that were living north of Washington State weren't as badly affected. And the outbreaks often occurred in the warmer months of the summer. And so if we can take steps to reduce climate change's impacts and help these animals adapt to the warmer waters, then we can curb this disease.
In 2021, the Center for Biological Diversity submitted a petition to list the sunflower sea star under the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act of 1973 provides a framework to conserve and protect endangered and threatened species and their habitats, both domestically and abroad. Once a species is listed under the Act, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is responsible for implementing this Act, take further steps to conserve the threatened species and their ecosystems. The National Marine Fisheries Service proposed to protect the species as threatened in 2023, though neither of these listings have been finalized as of yet. Kilduff explains how the Endangered Species Act works and what she hopes will happen with the sunflower sea star now that a cause has been identified for the sea star wasting disease.
So the Endangered Species Act is remarkably successful at keeping animals from going extinct. And because of the magnitude and the geographic range of the sea star wasting disease, extinction was a real possibility for the sea stars affected. And so the Endangered Species Act requires the government to respond to petitions asking for an animal to be listed. And the government did that after we submitted the petition and proposed listing sunflower sea stars as threatened. And then the act also requires them to make a final decision and designate critical habitat and also issue protective regulations to the extent necessary. So we're really hoping that this new research will spur the government to act, protect the sunflower sea star on the Endangered Species Act, and then issue a regulation that will help stop the spread of this disease and recover the sea star.
With this new information, there's now a new hope that this will encourage the NOAA and other agencies to help protect the sunflower sea star and its ecosystems before further damage can be done.
Well, the sunflower sea star is a great example of a small animal having really huge, noticeable impacts in our oceans. And it just affirms that we need to protect biodiversity and act quickly because the oceans are changing rapidly because of climate change and there are new threats. But we have the tools to keep our healthy oceans, and so we need to use them.
For more information about the sunflower sea star and conservation efforts, the website is fisheries.noaa.gov/species/sunflower-sea-star. In state news, activists celebrate appeals court victory on order barring discriminatory ICE practices in Los Angeles. KPFA's Sophia Rais Elfeni reports.
After a major court victory regarding immigrant detentions in Los Angeles, lawyers and plaintiffs in Vasquez Perdomo versus Noem held a news conference to highlight the significance of the ruling and urge the public to stay engaged. On Friday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals denied the federal government's request to pause a temporary restraining order blocking federal agencies, including Homeland Security, from carrying out what the court described as unlawful actions in Los Angeles and surrounding areas. The TRO was originally granted to stop federal agents from making unconstitutional stops and to ensure detained individuals have access to legal counsel. The federal government is appealing the order, but for now, the court says it must remain in effect. Chandra Bhatnagar is the director of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California.
Quite simply, the courts have accepted our very clear proposition. Stopping and detaining people because of what they look like, what language they speak, or where they come from is unconstitutional and morally indefensible. It is bigotry, pure and simple.
Since June 6th, over 2,300 people in the LA area have been detained by federal agents and denied due process, regardless of their immigration status. Some still remain in detention centers. Angelica Salas, director of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, says organization members, as well as callers to their rapid response hotline, have described case after case of extrajudicial arrests that rely primarily on a person's race, the location where they lived and worked, the job they undertook, and whether they spoke Spanish or spoke English with an accent. The federal government argues that the court's order is too broad and interferes with lawful immigration enforcement. They claimed factors like language, race, and location when making stops can be part of building reasonable suspicion. ACLU senior staff attorney Mohammed Tajsar, a lawyer for the plaintiffs, says the law is straightforward.
You know, this was not a difficult legal case. This was not a case where we had to push the law. The law existed here. We relied on the Supreme Court's precedents to ensure that the federal government cannot racially profile people and cannot stop and deprive people of their liberty simply for existing.
Tajsar continued by describing the federal government's stance in court.
They went to the federal appellate court and acted confused. And what the judges told them there and what they said to them in their decision is this was not a confusing order. This injunction, this TRO, was not confusing. The law is not confusing. If you are brown, you cannot be stopped simply because you're brown.
Adding to Tajsar's points, lawyer Batanjar pointed to hypocrisy in the federal government's claims.
On one hand, the government says it's not engaging in racial profiling. On the other hand, it seeks to fight an order that prevents it from engaging in racial profiling. We know the reason for this hypocrisy. The government's actions have been unjust and illegal, and they cannot defend their own record.
The court's rejection of the federal government's argument suggests the courts are not convinced that the federal actions are lawful. It sends a message that the courts are willing to step in and limit executive power when constitutional rights are at stake. Meanwhile, at the news conference, lawyer Tajsar said people's rights are clear.
And they come from the U.S. Constitution, and it doesn't matter your status, it doesn't matter your color, it doesn't matter what work you do, it doesn't matter where you are protected by those rights. These rights travel with you regardless of where you go. So my message to everybody in Southern California is, if you see something, say something.
The short-term temporary restraining order is in effect until the courts hear the next round of this litigation. The court will consider whether to issue a longer-term preliminary injunction on September 24th. This is Sophia Rais Alfeni for Pacifica Evening News, KPFA.
California legal advocates call for civility and respect for justice system. Suzanne Potter reports.
Groups that fight for a free and fair judicial system are speaking out against violence, threats, and insults targeting judges in California and across the country. Data from the U.S. Marshals Service, as reported by the New York Times, show that 277 judges were threatened since last October. The number of threats spiked in March and April. Around the same time, President Donald Trump and others began condemning jurists who blocked administration policies. Los Angeles attorney Paul Kiesel founded the nonpartisan nonprofit group Speak Up for Justice.
The problem is there's a lot of rhetoric about our judges. We need to address it by all of us recognizing the importance of our justice system and not getting on a bandwagon to start attacking our judges simply because we don't like their decisions.
5 years ago, a disgruntled attorney shot and killed the son of New Jersey Judge Esther Salas. Kiesel says federal judges in the Ninth Circuit have been threatened merely because they're based in California. And last month, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem went on TV to insult an L.A. federal judge who issued an injunction blocking immigration agents from detaining people solely based on their race, occupation, or the language they speak. Kiesel says when public officials attempt to smear judges, it undermines the rule of law.
When the Homeland Secretary refers to a judge as an idiot for feeling that individuals in this country are entitled to due process, we begin to denigrate the guardrail that is our justice system.
Since taking office, President Donald Trump has retaliated against multiple law firms that employ or represent people involved in his criminal prosecutions and impeachment trials. He has tried to limit their government contracts and block entry to federal buildings. Several firms sued and won an injunction. Other firms gave in and agreed to pay a large fine. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Texas Republicans fail again to vote on GOP redistricting plan as Democratic lawmakers hold out in other states. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The Texas State House of Representatives convened in a special session Tuesday in a second attempt to hold a vote on a Trump-inspired redistricting plan. But the second time did not go any better than the first. The session lasted less than 6 minutes, barely enough time for a prayer, the Pledge of Allegiance, and some remarks by Republican House Speaker Dustin Burroughs.
This morning, I met with the leadership of the Texas Department of Public Safety to get a full briefing on their efforts to locate and return the members who are actively trying to thwart the legislature from performing its duties. DPS is actively working to compel their attendance after I signed their civil arrest warrants yesterday, and will continue to do so until those members are back in this chamber.
Republicans have threatened Texas Democratic lawmakers with steep fines, arrests, and even removal from office after they left the state to prevent a vote on a redrawn congressional map. But following through on the tough talk may not be so easy. Legal experts and even Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton say most of the consequences would be difficult to enforce with lawmakers safely camped out in sympathetic blue states, and so effectively out of reach of Texas law enforcement. David Frumkin of the University of Houston Law Center said the removal effort and bribery charges would be on weak legal ground, and the threats of arrests and investigations are more likely meant to intimidate. So far, the Texas Democrats are not sounding intimidated. Their response to the threats? Bring it on. On Monday, Texas Democrats joined news conferences in Illinois with Governor J.B. Pritzker and in New York with Governor Kathy Hochul. On Tuesday, they spoke out in Massachusetts, where they were hosted by Governor Mara Healey, who pledged her support.
This is, to be really clear about it, a partisan, craven, political power grab attempt by the President of the United States, Governor Greg Abbott, and AG Paxton. That's what this is. Quite simple. And it's done to further an agenda that's about protecting them and their power and the president's perception of power. It's outrageous, and it impacts all of us across this country.
Massachusetts Secretary of State William Galvin was also on hand to show his support. He said, democracy started here, and we want to protect it.
You know, Trump loves to use the word rigged. It's one of his favorite words, rigged and stolen. Well, he's the master thief here. He's the one who's trying to crack open the safe on democracy and rip its contents all over the place.
The Texas redistricting plan was pushed by President Trump, who wants five new safe Republican House seats ahead of the midterm congressional elections. Trump justified his plan in a phone interview with MSNBC Tuesday, where he said California and Illinois are gerrymandered.
And we have an opportunity in Texas to pick up five seats. We have a really good governor, and we have good people in Texas. And I won Texas. I got the highest vote in the history of Texas, as you probably know. And we are entitled to five more seats.
That's not the view of the Texas Democrats. Carol Alvarado is a state senator from the Houston area.
This is coming to you. You're next. This is not a Texas problem. This is a United States of America problem. Today, President Trump said that he was entitled to five more seats in Texas, five more Republican seats. And we're here to say nobody is entitled. The people of those districts are entitled to those seats.
The Texas Democrats call the redistricting plan racist because of the way it dilutes the vote of African Americans and Latinos. State Senator Nathan Johnson of Dallas picked up on Trump's claim of Democratic gerrymandering, saying Texas Republicans do it every 10 years. He says now they're doing it in the middle of the decade because of what he calls their failed leadership and bad policies.
That's what's wrong with this. Are we going to do this every 2 years? Every time the administration does something that the voters hate, they redraw the maps to insulate themselves from the democratic process. That's dangerous, and that's what's happening.
Texas House Republicans plan to reconvene again on Friday, when they'll take another stab at voting on new congressional maps. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A pair of rural counties in eastern Arizona could soon start seeing significant investments in fiber and broadband networks. The funding is part of a multi-state settlement with two national telecommunications companies. KJZZ's Gabriel Piet-Tarazio has more on how it may help some tribal members get connected.
Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays announced that Frontier and Verizon have agreed to spend $8 million across Navajo and Apache counties, home to some of the state's biggest land-based tribes.
I'm never, ever going to stop bird-dogging this for these two counties because they deserve better. Just because you live in a rural county doesn't mean that these telecommunications companies can treat you differently.
For context, tribal lands make up two-thirds of Navajo County, while Apache County has about 70%, containing swaths of the Navajo, Hopi, Zuni, and White Mountain Apache reservations. Latest census data shows that more than half of all residents there are indigenous. The FCC reported in 2020 that almost a fifth of those living on tribal lands lacked access to broadband compared to 4% off-reservation. Part of this tentative settlement requires providers to find and fix the root causes of regular 911 outages on top of conducting a network-wide audit. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piet-Tarazio.
Food security, climate change, and increased tension with Russia is top of mind for residents in Alaska's Bering Strait region, and it was one of the topics at the recent Arctic Encounter Conference in Anchorage. Hundreds of people, including politicians, researchers, and indigenous knowledge holders, gathered for the event. Vera Kinnikok-Metcalf is the executive director of the Eskimo Walrus Commission. She lives in Nome and was born in Savunga, a small village on St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea. The community is located closer to Chukotka in eastern Russia than to the U.S., and Metcalf says residents have a lot in common with their neighbors.
Many of our families, relatives, kins originated in Chukotka. So we have this close connection, not just with marine mammals, but people to people.
Metcalf says climate change has real consequences for residents in her region who subsist on mammals migrating through the Bering Strait. A warming Arctic affects those migrations. Unstable ice conditions also make whaling and walrus hunting more dangerous. The geopolitical climate has also been changing, according to panelists who spoke at a session which focused on conflict and cooperation in the region. Russia has been strengthening its relationship with China since invading Ukraine in 2022. As waters stay ice-free longer, that means shipping, fishing, and military activities on the Russian side have been growing as well, and contributing to tension between Russia and the U.S. Captain Steve White is the president of Marine Exchange of Alaska. He says the growth of Russian vessel traffic is noticeable.
We know that traffic is increasing through the Bering Straits. And you can just say, well, just numbers-wise, you know, it's more than doubled in, you know, the last 10 years. The season, the amount that, of time that vessels are transiting is also increasing.
White says it's important to look at how this increased activity is affecting locals. Historically, the Bering Strait region has been a place of collaboration, according to the Walrus Commission's Metcalf. Russian and American scientists and locals have worked together to protect their marine subsistence resources and exchange cultural knowledge. A lot of that work has come to a halt in recent years, but Metcalf and other speakers say they hope that collaboration returns. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Sophia Reyes Elfeni, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.